Good morning once again. The weather has turned nice. It rained last night, and I got up early this morning, and it was nice to watch daylight. I was going to say sun up, but the sun didn't actually show up until later in the morning. But that's always, it's always nice, you know. We hear a lot of what is going on in this world, and most of it is not good. But then when I look out my back window and notice that the cows are out there grazing just like they always have been, and the birds are singing, and the sun comes up exactly when it is supposed to, it is a great reminder that God is sovereign, and that the world as a whole is still functioning. It is the human part of it that causes all the problems. We want to continue our study in the book of Daniel, and we come to a passage. We're going to cover Daniel chapter 4. We might have to speed read a little bit of it because Daniel chapter 4 has 37 verses. But I do want to point out some things about this chapter that are a little bit different from the rest. This particular passage is one that Nebuchadnezzar authored in the first person. He writes it. And it's interesting that that is the case because it's about a very personal experience that a sovereign had in learning that God is, in fact, the God Most High. You know, we studied the previous books, and you know, Nebuchadnezzar has already had two encounters with God, and always acknowledged that the God of Daniel is, in reality, the God Most High. But what he didn't recognize, and what is apparent here, is he did not recognize God as the one and only God, rather just another deity among many. What is recorded here is a 8-year episode. It begins with a dream, and it ends with him being banished after 1 year to 7 years of craziness, if you want to use that word, after which he acknowledges God. So that's the overview. Let's notice here what Nebuchadnezzar the king wrote. Quote, "To all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me." So here he talks about the Most High God. And Nebuchadnezzar, you know, recognizing the Hebrew God as a powerful deity, does not recognize him as the truly one and only God. Like I mentioned, he had a couple of encounters already. One when Daniel interpreted the dream that no one else could interpret or make known. And the other one was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. "I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are his signs and how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation." He's beginning, you know, and he's writing this obviously after everything had occurred. So he acknowledges here that God's dominion goes from generation to generation. That's why I always feel very confident when I can latch on to a biblical principle and put it into practice, because it remains in force from generation to generation. Oh, there may be times in which people marshal forces against such principles, but in the end, God is sovereign. And so even a Gentile king, the most powerful one at that time, had to was brought to his knees in a very literal sense to recognize that God is sovereign. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace. I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts on my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. Therefore I issued a decree to bring all the wise men of Babylon before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the astrologers, and the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers came in, and I told them the dream, but they did not make it known to me, its interpretation. And the question is, why? Why was that? actually, this particular dream is not that difficult to interpret, because of the analogous nature of the dream. So some commentators state that the astrologers and soothsayers did not want to make it known to the king because they were afraid if they did, they would become bowling balls. And back then that was not uncommon. But at last Daniel came before me. His name is Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. In him is the spirit of the holy God. And I told him the dream before him, saying, Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy God is in you and no secret troubles you, explain to me the visions of my dream that I have seen and its interpretation. So then he repeats the dream. And that's interesting that Daniel was called Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God, which is written in verse 8. You know, his God was Bel-Marduk. So he named Daniel after a pagan deity, and yet said, the spirit of the holy God is in you. You know, this looks and is contradictory. As often is the case in our culture, you know, you acknowledge God on the one hand and then do something diametrically the opposite. Particularly if you're a politician. I was listening to a sermon this morning that made reference to the recent political conventions, in one case where the name of God was not mentioned, and then when they realized that it wasn't real popular, they tried to reinsert it, and did. The minister I was listening to raised the question on which one was worse, to leave the name of God off an agenda that, among other things, endorsed abortion, or to try to reinsert his name upon something that God considers an abomination. It's a good question. But I think it highlights the fact that just because people or politicians pay lip service to God doesn't really mean anything. In fact, it may mean that they're taking, in many cases, they're simply taking God's name in vain. And Nebuchadnezzar was no exception. These were the visions of my head while on my bed. I was looking, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached to the heavens, and it could be seen to the ends of all the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of heaven dwelled in its branches. And all flesh was fed from it. And I saw in the visions of my head while on my bed, there was a watcher, a holy one coming down from heaven, and he cried aloud, and said thus, chop down the tree and cut off its branches, strip its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get out from under it and the birds from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump and roots in the earth. Bound was a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field. Let it be wet with dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts on the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the heart of an animal, and let seven times pass over him. I think, as I mentioned before, this dream was really not that difficult to interpret. And I think it's understandable why Nebuchadnezzar was afraid and troubled. Because, you know, the connection could be made fairly quickly. But I'd like to read from a book entitled A History of Israel, and it's written by an historian named Walter Kaiser. And just to give us an idea of the extent and the majesty, remember the tree, it says, could be seen to the ends of the earth. It was lovely. It had fruit in abundance. Walter Kaiser writes this about Babylon. It was a huge square, 55.25 miles in circumference, making it nearly two-thirds the area of New York City. It was a big place, surrounded by a series of walls that made it virtually impregnable. Robert Calloway, who excavated Babylon for 18 years, verified how security-conscious Nebuchadnezzar was. The city walls were surrounded, according to Calloway, with a brick wall 22 1/3 feet thick, with a space outside that wall some 38 feet wide, then another brick wall 25 feet thick. In the event that this outer wall was breached, the invader would be trapped between two walls. Inside the inner wall was another 12-foot-thick wall. Every 160 feet, the walls were topped by watchtowers and 360 towers in all, reaching the height probably of some 90 feet. When you think about that, and what it took to construct that back then, obviously you had the convenience of slave labor to construct all of it. He also constructed the city gates of cedar wood covered with strips of bronze. Numerous gates were installed in the walls, the most famous of these, the Ishtar Gate, now on display in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, was 15 feet wide, and its arched passage was 35 feet above the level of the street. And this gate led directly into the processional way, which was used primarily for the great annual New Year's festival. The pavement was 73 feet wide and was lined with a series of 120 lions. The Ishtar Gate in the Pergamon Museum is worth seeing. I've been there, and what they did after they excavated it in what is now Iraq, they moved it to Berlin and reconstructed it. It says here it's, let me see here, 15 feet wide. So, I mean, the width isn't all that wide, but the height, and what impressed me was the blue tile that were preserved all the way to this day. Now, they did replace a few of them that had gotten damaged or broken, but it was largely intact because it got covered by, you know, the sands of time, as it were. But when I visited the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, and you walk through that gate, and they had some of the lions behind it just to kind of give you an impression of what the processional way looked like, I thought, you know, Daniel, the prophet Daniel, walked through this gate. It's also a remarkable testimony to the accuracy of the Bible. Along this processional way was the famous ziggurat, or stage tower, known as the Itamenaki, the house of the foundation of heaven and earth, which rose 300 feet high and could be seen for miles around the city. It is estimated that some 58 million bricks were used in the construction of this tower. And atop of this seven-stage Terence Tower was the temple of Marduk, the god of Babylon. So it was a big city, a project, all of which Nebuchadnezzar, as we will see, thought he had built. And in a sense, he did. Continuing in verse 17, this decision is by the decree of the watchers and a sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets it over the lowest of men. This dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, declare its interpretation, since all the wise men of my kingdom are not able to make known to me the interpretation, but you are able, for the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. You know, Daniel is just a remarkable man. You know, he is, and think about it, he is the head of all the magicians. The king appointed him over that. And yet the king recognizes that there is something very different about Daniel. And the reason he gives is that the Spirit of the Holy God is in you. That should also be the case about us. The people that we interact with should recognize that there is something very different about us. Then Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished for a time, and his thoughts troubled him. So the king spoke and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation trouble you. Belteshazzar answered and said, my lord, may the dream concern those who hate you and its interpretation concern your enemies. Daniel obviously did not really want to declare to the king what was going to happen either. You know, you're in front of the most powerful king of that time, and what he's about to declare to him was not going to be popular. Notice what he says. The tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to heavens, and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely, and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelled, and on whose branches the birds of the heaven had their habitation. So he repeats this. You know, as I mentioned, Ishtar Gate was a, how do I describe the blue? It was a light blue. Somebody said something. Now, I know the color, it just escapes me at the moment. But I mean, it was magnificent. You know, when we're the dream here described the magnificence of what he had built. for example, and this is from the same author, Babylon was a marvel of city planning. On a mount called Khazar, Nebuchadnezzar built one of his most impressive palaces. Its walls were made of yellow brick, and the floors were of white and mottled sandstone. Near this palace was the famed Hanging Gardens, considered one of the seven wonders of the world. He had the Hanging Gardens. So here it talks about the tree who had lovely leaves and fruit in abundance. I mean, it was a big system. It was Babylon the Great, if you will. It was working, quote unquote. And then in verse 22, he lowers the boom. It is you, O king, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. And inasmuch as the king saw a watcher, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, chop down the tree and destroy it, but leave its stump and roots in the earth, bound with a band of iron and bronze in the tender grass of the field, let it be wet with dew of heaven, and let him graze with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over him. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my lord the king. They shall drive you from men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. They shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you till you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. Think about that. You're king. You live in a palace. You have the entire empire at your beck and call. And Daniel delivers the message, you're going to be driven away from all of this. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by being righteous, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. Perhaps there may be a lengthening of your prosperity. And then there was 1 year for him to make a decision, which apparently he did not take Daniel's counsel. Verse 28, then it came upon the king Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months. He was walking about the royal palace of Babylon. The king spoke, saying, is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? It's not unlike political rhetoric that you hear today. We will rebuild. We will be stronger. We will pursue. And I will do this. And if I am president, we will do that. Verse 31, while the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. And they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. They shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. Nebuchadnezzar ruled at the pleasure of God. Nebuchadnezzar was used by God to bring judgment to Judah for their sins. Nebuchadnezzar, this was, like I said, the third encounter that he had with God. The first one was his first dream, which Daniel both revealed to him and then interpreted. And then the second one was with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But he did not acknowledge, as we read in verse 30, that it was God that gave it to him. He says, by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty. Verse 33, that very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet, was the dew of heaven till his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. It's a pretty graphic picture, isn't it? You go from being a powerful, influential ruler to literally becoming like a beast. Obviously, God gave him a serious mental illness, and he was driven from men. How the mighty have fallen. I mean, this is one example in history, but the principle that is at work here is pride goes before a fall. And it doesn't matter who you are and what station of life you're in. When we get to the point where we think we're doing it on our own, and that's a human struggle. You know, I think somehow it is so human to want to control our own destiny and do it ourselves. But ultimately, God is the one that determines who is in charge. And I think that's also instructive given the decision the nation made this week. I mean, it's almost eerie when you think about it. The current president that we have appears to be unstoppable. Nothing sticks. And the agenda that has been put forward is frightening. But, as I've said a number of times when I've been speaking to you, when has it been any different? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar, pick your leader, Manasseh, Nero of Rome, Hitler of Germany. Leaders have risen and fallen, and God has allowed that to occur in order, like in this case, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar was a pagan king. A brutal man. You notice what was mentioned here in Daniel's counsel. He was advised to break off his sins and show mercy to the poor, which he did not do. And yet God used him very powerfully to punish Judah, to bring judgment upon them. I read one columnist this week who said America has voted judgment on itself. And I hope he's wrong, but it rings true. It does ring true. Verse 34. And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. So now you have him speaking in first person, acknowledging that the Most High has dominion. Talk about an about face. What 7 years of craziness, I guess, can do. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. No one can restrain his hand or say, "What have you done?" I mean, Job tried that. You know, Job had this conversation with God. But God is sovereign. God will not be mocked. What is done in secret becomes public. I mean, we have seen that in the last several weeks over and over again. It just works that way. And an analysis of the election shows, if the numbers are accurate, and I believe that they are, that Obama was elected in large part because of the women that voted, who came out in droves to vote for their right to choose. That turned out to be a central issue. Again, what we have seen is a referendum on the moral conscience of this nation. And I shared some statistics with you a few weeks ago, that 74% of women that have abortions do so for convenience. It's an astonishing statistic. It is also, I believe, going to be a judgment against us. God is not mocked. Not even Nebuchadnezzar, as we have seen here, in all his power. And even though God had used him powerfully to bring punishment to the nation of Judah, because they deserved it, at the end of the day, his time of judgment also came. And God warned him. He gave him an opportunity, a space of 12 months, to break off his sins and to show mercy to the poor. He didn't. So he ate grass for 7 years. But then he acknowledged God in a deeper way. I always hope that I can somehow learn a little bit easier than that. You know, teach me. Let me learn from the mistakes of others and not from my own. So we all think, I mean, it's human, that somehow you're the exception. Nebuchadnezzar was no exception, even though he was king. And neither are we. At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added to me. Now, isn't that remarkable? He was driven from the kingdom, schizophrenic or worse, and yet when he recognized that it was the Most High God that had dominion, when he came to himself, when he understood that very important principle, everything that he had lost was restored back to him. And it says, excellent majesty was added to me. So he was restored to what he had previously and more, which is a principle that we see repeated throughout the scriptures. The same thing was true with Job, was it not? You know, his former, his latter life, he had more children, he had more riches, he had more camels, he had more donkeys than he had previously. After a severe trial and change of heart. The lesson, I believe, for us is to allow our heart to be malleable so that change can occur over a period of time in incremental steps instead of having to, quote unquote, eat grass like an ox for 7 years. Verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, all of whose works are truth, and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to abase. Wow. And yet, that principle has held true down through time. Those who walk in pride, he is able to abase. Humility is a wonderful virtue. It is also uncanny, because the minute you recognize you've got it, it tends to go away. Ever thought about that? Pride emerges, as the author of Screwtape Letters so articulately wrote. Pride in our humility emerges when we recognize that we've got a measure of it. Nebuchadnezzar's dream, his lack of repentance or refusal, whatever the case might have been, even though God graciously gave him 12 months, resulted in having to go through a 7-year banishment from everything that he thought he had built. But in the end, the result was good. He recognized that it wasn't him, but rather that he had enjoyed privilege because God had used him to bring about his will. So I hope that this overview of the book of Daniel, this chapter of Daniel, has given us some things to think about in our lives. You know, I think it's important, I mean, prophecy on the grand scheme of things, and actually, if you bear with me for a minute, I mean, there are some things embedded into this passage that reach to our time. I mean, the 7 times 7, if you do the calculation on that, the 2,520 years reaches down to 1981. And, you know, there, since the 60s, a lot of significant things have happened. But I think more importantly than constructing formulas of this nature, and I'm not against it at all. I think that's important to look at in the appropriate way. But I just want to emphasize that I think it is more important, at least it is for me, to look and learn from Nebuchadnezzar the principles and the dynamics that were at work so that we can spare ourselves from this type of intervention by God in our lives. Do him a favor and us. Thank you for your time.